The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I'm just amazed. Again, thank you to our listeners for engaging not only in the content of commentary, but then engaging with each other in a way that is considerate, in a way that is constructive, in a way that is respectful. It speaks to the quality and character of who you are as an individual and your pursuit of truth.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, part two of our question and answer sessions.
Kevin, you know, when we go and travel and do presentations for our clients and whatnot, my favorite part is the Q&A. Doing formal stuff is...
That's why you go hours and hours after the presentation.
I ask the question, who cares about PowerPoints? I certainly don't. I mean,
who cares about midnight? Yeah, and the people have two-hour drives home.
That's what happens when Q&A gets really engaged. It can be really fun, really insightful. And again, we appreciate you as listeners throwing your hats in the ring to say, hey, we want to know about this. We'd love to talk about that. Because understand, we would love to sit down over a cup of coffee or have a beer with you, something where we had this conversation with you and it didn't end.
Something that strikes me both at these presentations when you do them live and the questions that come in on these commentaries, people are engaged. They're listening. They'll say, okay, well, back in September, you said such and such. And then they'll start piecing together a question that's very well put together. So thank you very much. Now, I told the listeners last week that I was really looking forward to this first question. It made me laugh. But this is a question that we will be hearing an awful lot about here coming up into this next political season. It's an economic theory that's being asked about. But let me back up and read the whole letter because it's worth it. Okay, here we go. He says, hello. I'll try to make this as brief and condensed as possible. About 6 weeks ago, David McIlvaney called me at 11 a.m. on a weekday while I was sitting around in my underwear watching the markets. He didn't identify himself. All he said was, hello, may I speak with Bill? Speaking. Hello, this is McIlvaney Wealth calling. I was surprised to get the call, being based in Toronto, in addition to being a very loyal listener to the weekly commentary. As the conversation progressed for a minute or two, I had the distinct feeling that I know this voice. It was, actually, Dave McIlvaney himself. Is this Dave McIlvaney I'm talking with? He asked. Yes, it is, Dave replied. Well, I was standing at the time, and I had to locate my easy chair and sit down. I'm 53. If I was 27, I would have swung from the branches. For the next 45 minutes, David and I, both philosophy undergrads who regard macroeconomics as merely the philosophy of money, chewed the fat on a delightful range of topics. Economy, finance, geopolitics, Trump in 2020, moral philosophy. One aspect of our conversation helped me immensely because I was embroiled in the subject. I asked David what his thoughts were regarding MMT, modern monetary theory. Now, Dave, that's what I'm talking about. We're going to be hearing a lot more about that. Dave said, oh, you mean chartalism, he replied. Oh, you mean chartalism. I had to look up chartalism, he says. I love looking things up. David went on with a robust answer. I do distinctly remember that he was not nearly as taken as I. And the MMT is growing momentum, such as I predict it will feature prominently in the Republicrats for the 2020 election platform. David will no doubt know that Bernie Sanders' economic advisor, Stephanie Kelton, recently wrapped up her MMT tour in Australia. The question I put to both David and Kevin, I'd be grateful if both voices weighed in on this one because I enjoy the insights from both, is MMT, modern monetary theory, a crock, or can it supplant orthodox economic ideology, which treats the national economy as if it were a private household that could go bankrupt via over-indebtedness? Is Warren Mosler a kook or the next U.S. Treasury Secretary? It's a can of worms I'd love to see David and Kevin tangle with. Thank you and good night, Bill.
Well, the main takeaways from modern monetary theory is that you have no budget constraints.
Right.
That's one thing.
No barriers, right? Budget.
And that economies are self-stabilizing. Now, that's how they would describe it, and it's a very confusing path to that conclusion. I'm not even sure what the MMT crowd means by it. I know what self-stabilizing means within the context of a gold standard, but there's a very convoluted route to get to an economy which is self-stabilizing. I think another point on MMT is that it takes the government deficit, and it borrows from an accounting formula. This is legitimate to a degree. I think it's just misapplied. Where there is a deficit, there is also a surplus. What MMT would say is that the government's deficit is your surplus. And this is, again, where you start to feel the influence and the affinity with the Bernie Sanders.
You start smelling snake oil, because what they're promising is no deficit. We can just print as much as we want and it'll be fine.
Or infinite deficit. There's no budget constraints because we can print as much as we want.
Right.
And so, yeah, the irony is that modern, that first word in the MMT, it's not new. And John Law was the first that I know of that designed the system in his 1705 book, Money and Trade Considered. And then the subtitle was With a Proposal for Supplying the Nation with Money. This was the foundational work which got attention by the French monarchy and ultimately had him put in place as the equivalent of prime minister there in France, or managing, as a man from Scotland, the entire French monetary system. So study the period, and you'll see a focus on financial innovation. You'll see the abandonment of monetary constraints, and you'll see a great contrast between two characters of the period, John Law on the one hand, Richard Cantillon on the other. Cantillon was a contemporary of Law's, and as we began to see Law's whole system with the Mississippi scheme falter and lose legitimacy, Law was begging Cantillon to come back and help fix the system because there were some significant errors embedded in really this early 1700s version of MMT. So in the next few weeks, what we'll do is we'll take a very deep dive on Richard Cantillon. I think he's an important figure to be familiar with. And I'd love to have a conversation with his biographer, Antoine Murphy. Murphy wrote the definitive book, just republished in paperback by Oxford University Press, Richard Cantillon, Entrepreneur and Economist.
Yeah, the system absolutely requires a captive audience. Talk about a closed system. You know, if you're going to have a system where the government can print freely and as much as they want, you have to close it. And, you know, Carmen Reinhart told us, you have to create a captive audience.
Well, there's a contrast, too, between Law's system, which was one of control and centralized influence. And you're right, it did require a closure of the system to work, to function. Contrast that with Cantillon's view, which was really the entrepreneur is central to what develops within a capitalist system, although he wouldn't have called it a capitalist system. I don't know that he even would have used the language of free markets, but he saw the role of the entrepreneur and freedom and individual risk-taking as central, and that's where Cantillon came in with a wicked critique of John Law. So with Law's system, it meant that ultimately choices were limited, and there was a both a political and an economic price to pay if you're going to opt out. And so the man on the street ran into the Mississippi system for all the benefits that it offered, for the wealth that you could acquire, and for the trading rights to the New World. I mean, it really was an ingenious system, but it had some significant flaws. And that person who was running into the Mississippi system abandoned gold and silver. Meanwhile, you had smart money, had very wealthy and wise families in the French context who were hoarding specie. Specie is just a fancy name for gold and silver coins. And they did that in spite of the run up in the Mississippi shares in terms of value. When the systemic cracks began to appear, they continue to maintain their hoards of gold and silver outside the money and banking system. And what's really curious about this is they had chosen an opt-out. The MMT process, and again, that's what we call it today, but Law's system was really the early model, required closure. We mentioned that. If you owned gold, you were limited to 500 livres, which was virtually pocket change. And if you were found with more than 500 livres of gold or silver, you were threatened with total property confiscation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you were worth millions and millions in that day, finding a little bit of gold meant that you would lose everything. And again, to enforce the system, what did they do? They implemented exchange controls. You know, modern monetary theory goes well beyond Keynes, and it goes beyond Keynes to the great inspiration for centrally planned monetary experiments, and that is John Law in 1720. So MMT is a new theory in name only. If you're talking about Kelton, if you're talking about Mosler, if you're talking about Bernie Sanders or the Sanders of the world, they've been here before. And what's interesting to me is that the ideological failures are forgotten only because they've been given new names and we're not making the proper associations. So what is it in essence? We're playing with the nature of money. We're playing with the definition of money, and we're trying to gain the latitude that politicians have always wanted without restraints on the definition or use of money. That's as old as dirt. That's not modern, except in its most modern iteration.
Promising free money without ever having to pay it back is a little bit like a perpetual motion machine. The patent board will no longer even look at perpetual motion machines because they look like they work, but honestly, the science hasn't changed. The terminology to confuse has been modified. That's really when somebody says, let me show you why this one will work. This is modern monetary theory. And then they want to show you the math and show you how it works. It's still snake oil. It's still socialism. It's still promising perpetual motion. Okay, next question. Kevin and David, I hope you had a great year. Thank you for your episode on cryptocurrency. I teach blockchain, cryptocurrency, and artificial intelligence at college. I just taught a mixed audience of 50 in downtown Houston about blockchain. Everyone that attended the free event left with their own Python blockchain code. You guys nailed it, 95% right on the head. I was pleased. I know you're limited on time, so I have so much to add. I'd point out that blockchain does offer economic incentive to invest in faster processors and cheaper electricity. Okay, but he's going to jump, actually, Dave, in the question to SpaceX. SpaceX has put a car into Mars orbit and plans to land on Mars in 6 years. It's only a matter of 2 to 3 decades and artificial intelligent mining equipment. They'll be littering the solar system. And so here's the question of the year, he says. When all natural resources are no longer scarce, what assets will hold value? I think he's referencing mining asteroids, mining planets, mining in space. I think we need to address that. We've gotten a question like this before.
Yeah, and I think one of the constraints today is the economics, and perhaps that changes over time. But I think before we assume that gold will be as common as dirt because of what, first of all, may or may not exist on other planets or on asteroids, Kevin, I think maybe you could explain a little bit on stars and supernovas and the variance in matter that can exist, and maybe even the concentrations that might exist as a result.
Well, stars are very complex, but actually very simple. They start as hydrogen and they start fusing to heavier metals. They get to a point where they can't fuse anymore when they get to iron. And the theory is, and actually there's good evidence of this, that any heavier element then must be produced by supernova.
So you're talking about any element heavier than iron.
Than iron.
Has to be produced by a supernova.
What that means also is this. There's an awful lot of gold in the universe, but it's a long ways away and it's sparsely populated. So it's like everything else. So to think that we're not going to have need for whether it's precious metals, natural resources, what have you, even if it was free to go get, it would still be difficult. But here's the problem.
No, but supernovas are not exactly the most common occurrence, are they?
No, they're not. And that's the thing. That's what makes these elements rare. But here's the problem. You know, with the shuttle program, it was $10,000 a pound to loft something chemical combustion to space. Now it's dropped to about half that. And with some of the technology, like our listener was talking about, it could drop even more. But the cost, in our lifetimes, the cost of mining in space, I doubt that we're going to live to see the relevance of it.
Well, just to look at the economics today, and this is all back of the napkin, this is non-scientific, but first of all, there's lack of evidence that there's actual high-grade deposits, right? When you're exploring for gold, you need not only for it to be present, but you need it to be concentrated.
Right. They're speculating that it may be out there.
And may be out there in the universe is different than having it in a concentrated form, you know, where you can mine it. But you're talking about exploration and mining, which is a very expensive project here on terra firma. And the theoretical production costs, let's say for gold, we're talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars an ounce. And again, we've got SpaceX, we've got Elon Musk's other enterprises which are doing quite well, but only because of the willingness of politicians to bestow taxpayer dollars on those ventures, not because they're actually economical. Nevertheless, you mentioned $10,000 a pound to launch to space. On the basis of his subsidies and those going to SpaceX, he can launch at $5,000 a pound. And so I'm just thinking the Caterpillar Model 797. If you guys have ever seen one of those massive Caterpillar dump trucks, they weigh 1.23 million pounds. Okay. And assuming that you could alter the combustion engine and you've got an operable dump truck in space, the cost right. to get it into space and then operate it, we're talking about a single dump truck, you know, drum roll for the pun. It's astronomical.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's $6.15 billion.
Wow.
Assuming that new number of $5,000 a pound to launch. $6.5 billion just to get one Caterpillar dump truck into space. We're not talking about the ancillary operations or anything else that you would need for mining. I guess what I'm saying is I'm not worried today or really in multiple lifetimes that gold in space is going to dilute value here. Not yet.
Well, then let's go to the next question because that ties right in, not with space, but with gold. Hi, guys. Been listening to your weekly commentary for at least 8 or 9 years. Wow. Thank you. Knowing the short attention span of the average American, what's a quick way to explain the opportunity with precious metals? Now, pretend like you're in an elevator, Dave, and you're going down and you have to explain the answer to that question by the time you get to the first floor.
Right. Well, the first thing is to get someone's attention. The problem is I don't know how to do that, focusing on the most critical element of gold, because first and foremost, the opportunity is to preserve wealth and then secondarily to expand wealth thereafter. Right. And I think anyone who's in the elevator is going to want the story of how wealth can be gained instantly and with ease. Right. So that I think you have to step back and look at the process of why you own gold and what it's used for. If you treat it as money, if you use it as an insurance policy, then you're getting to the heart of the matter. So again, I think you look at preservation of wealth first, expansion of wealth thereafter. You could have nominal prices of gold increase depending on the value of the underlying currency. You know, let's say we're talking about the Venezuelan currency or Zimbabwean currency or how it marks in the market today in Japanese yen. Whatever it may be, the underlying currency and gold priced in that underlying currency could be 5 digits, could be 6 digits, could be 7, 8, it could be 9 digits. The real opportunity in gold is not in the capital appreciation, but in the capital preservation, right? When very few pockets of wealth have been preserved, it's the wealth that remains that goes a long way.
All right. Now you're on the 10th floor. You're still descending. Give us another point.
Well, I get back to insurance. Insurance and the role that gold plays as money. I mean, this is the key to understanding the real opportunity in gold. You have to follow the process through to realize it. Whether you're talking about shares or acres or square feet, gold buys it all. And it buys it at some exchange value. And that's where the magic happens. So again, you own gold to preserve wealth. You use your wealth in a transformative fashion when there's opportunity to do so. So I'm less concerned about capital appreciation and being priced in 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 digits, because again, that's more commentary on the value of the underlying currency. I want to know the exchange value into other real things. Land, plant, infrastructure of a company, square feet for an apartment complex, acres for a productive farm. This is where you begin to see your wealth used in a transformative fashion. And I think this is where my elevator speech ends.
Floor one. That's good. But, you know, this next question also ties in because we have seen what looks like control to a degree of the gold price through the futures market. So here's the question from Kay. Hi, this week you talked about government control or kill in relation to cryptos. Now, I'm wondering if the Federal Reserve or the U.S. government doesn't feel the same way about gold and silver. Is it a matter of don't fight the Fed when we set out to put 25% of our portfolio into gold and silver? If they succeed in setting the price of gold and silver as they've done for the last 5 years, we will be worse off than if we had put our money into treasuries or Apple shares. After all, this is what they want us to do. Then they would have succeeded in controlling us and killing gold and silver. P.S. I've listened to your commentary every week without fail for years. Well done. Thanks, Kay. Okay, so Dave, let's talk about this price control on gold.
Well, first of all, I think our conversation with Nazli Shukri a couple of years ago, we hit on who controls the internet and what the jurisdictions are. And the fact of the matter is governments all over the world do have kill switches. Anytime they want, they can shut it down. So to the degree that, you know, we're talking about cryptocurrencies, they can, in fact, control and kill. When you're talking about gold, you're talking about a diverse and dispersed market, a global market that no particular government controls. But I think Kay has a point here. If you're talking about this last five-year stretch, there's no doubt. That's a five-year time frame in which Apple shares and treasuries were the winner and gold, on a relative basis, the loser. I guess if you wanted to, you could choose other five-year stretches, other time periods where the opposite would have been true, where gold was the winner and Apple was the loser. Nevertheless, for those who've listened to our commentary through the years and have listened to Mark Faber, very often he'll conclude with sort of a rough asset allocation model of 25% in four different categories, 25% in metals, 25% in real estate, 25% in financial assets, stocks and bonds, 25% in cash or some sort of liquid format, short-term treasury bills or what have you.
So what about control and kill? Okay. Can they do control and kill with gold and silver long term?
That's the real part of the question. Is the controlling and killing of the gold market. And I don't buy it. Look at the gold market from 275 to 1900. That was not controlled. That was not killed. What we have had since then is a simultaneous cyclical bull market in financial assets. I think that's been driven to an exaggerated level. And frankly, the time frames exaggerated as well by central bank monetary policy. But we've had a cyclical bull in financial assets. At the same time, we've seen a cyclical bear in the gold market. And there's a psychological complement to this. We've got enthusiasm for financial assets and you have no enthusiasm for real and tangible assets. Now, we are talking about gold and silver here, but it's worth looking and saying, is the establishment controlling the entire commodities complex? Because if I take the GSCI, that is the Goldman Sachs Commodities Index, and compare it to the S&P 500, as one of our questioners does a little bit later, guess what you find? Commodities, the whole complex, is cheap relative to financial assets, the cheapest they've been, or as cheap as they've ever been in a 50-year period. So it's not as if you're controlling one versus the other. I think there's a psychology within the market which is more in tune with the pricing of the assets and not necessarily a command and control dynamic. If you're going to try to perpetuate the financial asset bubble, you will ultimately pay for that. You'll pay for that with a weaker currency. You'll pay for that with the exchange rate. What we have today is an open global economy. And that open global economy allows for individual actors to express their self-interest, to seek opportunistic ventures here and there in a way that is consequential to the trends, whether that's the bull market in stocks or the bear market in commodities. But trends are never perpetual. And I think this is a really key point. We look at the trend, which has been in place for 5 years, and say, all right, well, we should have been in Apple shares and treasuries, not gold. And we cannot infer from that that gold will forever be held back or the entire commodities complex will be held back. Trends are never perpetual. They run in cycles, just like financial assets too. They run in cycles because of the attendant psychology of those individuals participating in the trends. That psychology also runs in cycles. So regarding gold and silver, even the worst case scenario, let's say the government moves against and picks on one particular commodity or two commodities, gold and silver, with illegality, with confiscation, or with some sort of confiscatory capital gains tax. Even when the costs are high for an individual to preserve self and to preserve their wealth, individuals will find a path. Okay. Again, returning to Cantillon, you had in the context of John Law, the failure of that system, what is the modern iteration of that, modern monetary theory, exchange controls were in place. They had to close the system to make it work. Anything over 500 livres in gold and silver was illegal. You still had perspicacious, wise families not only owning the metals in large quantities, but they were able to ultimately get out of the country. And Cantillon This is how he made his second fortune.
Right.
He made his second fortune providing currency exchange out of a closed system. Was it legal? I don't know. But those who wanted to move out of French livre into specie, which was, you know, what we call gold and silver, Dutch guilders, British sterling, there is always a way. There is always a way out. There is always a way around. There is always a way under. There is always a way through. And this is, I think, the point. You cannot control the market. If individual actors, singly or en masse, decide that they want out, around, under, or through, it will get done. It will get done. That is what history shows. The markets speak, and ultimately, no plutocrat, no autocrat, no dictator can determine the course of a particular market. So I love the question, Kay. I love the question. I think we are finished with this particular cycle, which has favored financial assets and has left it to the dustbin of history and relevance. At least that's the current meme. The entire commodities complex.
You know, the thing that amazes me is every single bubble we could talk about, if you had moved to gold before the thing popped, you'd make a fortune. We've seen this with Bitcoin. We've seen this with other bubbles. Even the Mississippi scheme 300 years ago with Cantillon. It's interesting. Where do people move when they move out of a bubble before it pops? Gold. It's because it preserves value. Now, moving on to the next question. I've heard from many folks that there's a coming financial reset. Do you have any thoughts on what that would look like as it relates to bank balances and especially personal debt balances? I'm most concerned about mortgages. Could you see a gold-backed currency as a result of this reset? On another note, I'm thrilled with the Vaulted app. It came just as we were looking for a safe place to park some cash because we're going to need it later. Thanks for being so forward-minded. Okay, so gold-backed currency and a reset, Dave. What
yeah.
are you thinking?
Well, okay, right. Vaulted is a fit as a cash or savings alternative. And of course, you have the gold price volatility. That's implicit. But you're simply choosing between the currency that has stood the test of time and the currencies which are being purposefully and willfully degraded. Now, this is fascinating. And I'm sorry, a small rant. It's no longer by a hidden factor, the hidden inflation rate. It's as if our central planners have said, put the inflation target out there for people to see. It makes it less of a boogeyman and something to be feared. Inflation desensitization is what has occurred via targeting the rate.
Okay, but what about mortgages? Because that was the chief
okay,
concern
right.
of this question.
Right, so mortgages would likely be indexed along with other debts. So you have to keep in mind the central bank's penchant for keeping creditors intact. Can't allow creditors to be destroyed. So debt has to be indexed. The problem with the gold-backed currency, another part of the question, the problem with the gold-backed currency is not a problem inherent to the gold standard itself, but bankers and politicians both oppose it. They oppose it because it restrains both of those groups in their activities and in the commitments that they can make. And frankly, I mean, going back to Vaulted for just a minute, Vaulted was launched in part so that people could establish a saving system, which is their own gold standard. Right. So knowing the weakness of will, knowing the self-interest of 97% of the banking and political community, not all politicians fit into this, not all banking executives fit into this, but the majority in the community would implement policies which degrade the value of our currency. That means we have a choice to make.
Well, keeping consistent with that, then, the safety of something like a Vaulted app, okay, Bart asks this. He says, according to your website, the gold is stored at RCM, Royal Canadian Mint, which is a crown corporation, which means it's owned by the government of Canada. I'm interested in precious metals not only as a way of preserving the purchasing power of my savings in the long run, but also as a way of staying outside of the system. Due to concerns of a potential bank holiday in the event of another crisis, I'm against storing any precious metals in bank deposit boxes. Is McIlvany ICA not concerned that storing their clients' gold at a government corporation such as Royal Canadian Mint is highly risky, even more so than storing it at a local bank? I believe a better option would be to store physical metal at private vaults such as Loomis or Brinks. Will Vaulted app offer this option in the near future? On the podcast where I first heard of Vaulted app, Dave mentioned that gold can be stored at RCM, Royal Canadian Mint, or Switzerland. However, I was not able to find information on the Swiss option on your website. Can you please clarify?
The design of Vaulted is to be a cash and banking alternative. The assumption is that that is an in-the-system choice, but a diversification in terms of currency and maybe even geography. So the in-system versus out-of-the-system, the only out-of-the-system measure is to have physical gold in hand and perhaps be practicing midnight gardening or something like that. I want to reflect a little bit on the scale of risks here. There is a scale of risks if we're talking about credit and solvency risks. And these are, you know, corporations are at the lower end of that scale, much lower than sovereigns. So I think from that viewpoint, sovereigns are a better risk than corporations. And by the way, if you, Loomis, for logistics purposes, we use all the vaults that you can imagine on transportation companies in the world and have relationships with them. But again, I would take the balance sheet of Canada more seriously than the balance sheet of an individual company far more seriously. So again, you're still in the system with a Brinks or a Loomis. That distinction, I think, has to be made up front. So back to the scale of risks. We contrast the difference between sovereign and corporate risk, credit risk. That's there. Then comes, in my mind, a very critical distinction, countries that practice the rule of law and appreciate property rights and those that don't. And I think anywhere outside the Anglosphere, and you're taking on huge risks because those sovereigns that do not practice a robust rule of law and recognize property rights, you know, they're unconstrained. And you're taking massive risk there.
When I think the listener's asking a question, wanting Vaulted to be everything, but we also have multiple programs to get these things done. What he's talking about?
Yeah, I mean, our programs, we offer a variety of programs. Each is an iteration. And Vaulted, in my opinion, is the best specifically for a cash and savings alternative. And so this is defined for me by certain qualities. It's defined by the product, Kilo Bars, the purity, the liquidity of said product, the accessibility to the balance via the technology, the technology's robustness, and at the same time, the simplicity of it. I mean, one way of thinking of this is as a storage arrangement with the sovereign versus a deposit. There is a bailment here, which signifies that you are the owner and are renting the space. The product is not on the balance sheet of the entity storing it, nor can that product be loaned, nor can it be leased, nor can it be otherwise encumbered. So again, yes, it's in the system, but it also has all the other benefits and robustness of being a separate and sole asset of the client.
Well, let's go many steps away in this next question then, because ETFs are nothing like actually having gold in storage. And so the question goes, I've been buying mining stocks over the last few years while precious metals prices have been dipping. I own a few gold ETFs, such as GoldX and GDXJ. In the event of an equity collapse, what would happen if the investment firm who owns the ETF is forced to liquidate? Do you think it's less risky to own individual mining company equities rather than diversified mining ETFs in the event of an equity collapse?
Yep, GDX and GDXJ are both owned by VanEck. My dad was the national wholesaler of the original VanEck Gold Fund. And, you know, this goes back to the 60s and early 70s. The VanEck funds have weathered the early 70s sell-off, the 87 sell-off, the year 2000 sell-off, the 08, 09 catastrophe. And I'm not worried about them at this point. I have a personal preference. My personal preference is for core holdings of individual shares, the highest quality shares, with a supplement and a diversification through funds like the ones mentioned. So I would own the big boys outright, and I would own the juniors in a fund form for diversification, or as some would call it, diversification. but I think is a good strategy to use those. And as you mentioned earlier, there's a difference between ETFs and gold stored. Just one comment on that, although it wasn't a part of the question. GLD and SLV are both gold stored. The issue is, unless you're taking delivery of, say, $10 million.
It's not practical.
It's not practical. You can't take delivery of it. FedEx is not going to deliver it to your door. You don't have the same fungibility, which gives Vaulted that same as cash quality, just a choice of denomination in ounces versus greenbacks.
You know, Fiona is trying to look ahead at taxes on the same thing we're talking about. So I'll read her question. She says, an old adage usually attributed to Ben Franklin in a 1789 letter states that our new constitution is now established and has an appearance that promises permanency. But in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death, and taxes. The investment community seems certain that you're going to pay a lower tax rate when you retire, so the majority of investment tax is deferred. Given the level of government debt, I wonder at the wisdom of this assumption. How do we plan for future investment taxation beyond our current planning assumptions? Is there a strong argument for a fiscal and economic context in which you anticipate and act differently today for tomorrow based not only on investment growth, but tax exposure? With government and institutional control and rules on virtually all of our monetary and investment instruments, I'm not sure how we see that we can truly secure our wealth as our own anymore. Thanks for the show, Fiona.
Wow. What a fabulous question. Series of observations, and I feel unqualified to answer it. So I understand there's going to be some holes here. I think one of the ways that you act differently today for tomorrow is by, if you are able, taking traditional IRAs and utilizing the Roth conversion option. You're settling up with Uncle Sam now. You're not assuming that rates are going to be more favorable in the future. And frankly, I think the current administration, this is about as good as it's going to get. If the current administration loses in 2020 and we bring in, you know, somebody of a Bernie Sanders ilk, I think you can look at a massive attack on wealth in all its forms. And so I would want to settle the score with Uncle Sam as quickly as possible. That would be one way of bringing the future into the present and acting differently today for tomorrow. So I think there's a couple of other things to keep in mind, and this relates to how to plan for future investment taxation beyond our current planning assumptions, maybe taking it into the next generation. So let me make some assumptions about intergenerational planning and wealth strategies, which might be apropos. One, decide on what assets you have, which are tradable assets. That would be one category. Tradable assets, which in your time you are going to buy and sell. And there you're going to see whether it's coming out of a retirement account, income tax implications, or outside of a retirement account, merely capital gains tax implications. So now you've got one pocket designated tradable assets. That's in contrast to the second pocket of assets, which you would consider long-term or intergenerational assets. Now, think about this. Let's say that you own a stock portfolio, or like last week, the gentleman in Australia. Well, that's not a good example because it doesn't apply to U.S. tax code. But let's say there's somebody just like him who owns 13 kilo bars, and they want that to be an intergenerational asset. Well, upon your demise, the next generation gets a step up in basis. So rather than selling in your lifetime to simplify a portfolio and hand over only cash, keep in mind if you sell in your lifetime, you're going to trigger capital gains tax, and then you have an inheritance tax thereafter. If you allow the asset to pass from one generation to the next, the step up in basis takes care of the capital gain which would have existed. You see the value there of thinking long term. Mm-hmm. Now, there may be an inheritance tax depending on the total size of the estate. But I think two things, we talked about the traditional to Roth conversions and then deciding on what is in your universe of assets, which is tradable, first category, second category, intergenerational or long term in nature, and make sure you take advantage of that step up in basis.
Next question. How protected is our money sitting in bank savings accounts right now? When the next recession hits, will depositors be required to bail banks out? What's your thought on that? Are we the bailout of last resort again?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, they were a part of the bailout last time around. Just think creatively about this, right?
Right.
What we call financial repression. We've got low rates, negative rates. What are the purpose of keeping interest rates at a low level? This helps rebuild the capital within the banking system, and it's at the expense of the depositor. So, you know, you can say, hey, what's the bail-in? Well, that was an implicit bail-in as opposed to an explicit bail-in, and we call it financial repression. You can hide behind a bunch of words. At the end of the day, we did already have in the 08-09 one version of a bank bail-in.
And we're still bailing it out. The artificially low interest rates are part of that bailout.
That's right. And maybe that moderates over time, but one of the things you have to also consider is that we're also adding to, not necessarily the bank system's health, but we are adding to the government's health via the inflation tax. That's 2%. Nobody really thinks about 2%, but you have to. You have to recognize the size and scale of 2% when that's more than you might get in your bank deposit. So you earn less than 2% in your bank deposit and you give up more than 2% in an inflation tax. you're going to get hammered on both sides, right, either with low rates and what we call financial repression, or the inflation tax, which again is not necessarily directly beneficial to the banking system, but is very beneficial to government. The question, how protected is your money sitting in a bank savings account? I think we answered it.
Okay, Mr. Bibliography, this question is on education. What sources do you recommend to learn about our money system, including the BIS, the Federal Reserve, Treasury, Goldman Sachs, consumer banks? I've got to throw out right off the bat, Dave, The Creature from Jekyll Island is where you start.
Well, and I think the journey never ends. The question is, how far along do you want to go? And there's both degrees of complexity and detail, which, you know, at a later date may be very important and very intriguing to you, which on the front end are not seemingly relevant. So it depends on how far your curiosity takes you. But if you want the journey to never end as a lifetime learner in every category, whether it's psychology or market dynamics or economics or finance, in this case, the question is relating to the money system, Federal Reserve, the Treasury, banks. I'm going to give you a variety of names. Some of these are both expensive books and therefore out of reach, or too academic. But you started with a good one. The Creature from Jekyll Island gives the backstory to the creation of the Federal Reserve and, you know, lets you know that this is actually the third iteration of our central bank. We've tried it twice before. Now, it doesn't give you the history of the Riksbank, which was the first central bank in Sweden. It doesn't give you the creation of the Bank of England in 1694. There's a number of central bank iterations which preceded the Federal Reserve. All you get in The Creature of Jekyll Island is how the current central bank in the United States came to be. I think The Ascent of Money is an excellent book. The Ascent of Money by Niall Ferguson. Beyond The Ascent of Money, he has one that deals more with the history of interest rates and borrowing, which is The Cash Nexus, also by Niall Ferguson. The Cash Nexus is very intriguing. This Time is Different is a book by Carmen Reinhart, one of our commentary guests, and Ken Rogoff, who we quoted in last week's commentary, the Q&A, and it's 8 centuries of financial folly. Lo and behold, when you're studying financial folly, you get to read about banks, you get to read about central banks, you get to read about interesting corporate decisions and political decisions, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a read that I would encourage. The Curse of Cash, also by Ken Rogoff. The Curse of Cash is his argument for why we should be moving to a cashless society and moving beyond just the tools that the Federal Reserve has today to even broader tools. And so I think that is a good sort of modern iteration. It's sort of a popular read, The Death of Money by Jim Rickards, and The New Case for Gold, also by Jim Rickards too, which are, they read more like spy novels as opposed to some of the other books that I might give you, which are definitely more academic. Fragile by Design. Don't commit to this unless you're interested in 500 pages of small fine print, but a fascinating look. The subtitle is The Political Origins of Banking Crisis and Scarce Credit. A must read. That came from our bibliography, Alex Pollack, in a conversation with our banker friend, Alex Pollack. Harold James, also a contributor to the commentary here, International Monetary Cooperation Since Bretton Woods. The more boring the title sounds, the more likely it is to be an academic work, and the less likely the average person is going to want to spend time either buying it or reading it.
But so, the more likely it'll be in your library.
Be forewarned. Oh, yeah. Be forewarned. And then I think one last one, and this is one that has just, it's made a huge impact on me, is Giulio Galrodi's The Anatomy of an International Monetary Regime, The Classical Gold Standard, 1880 to 1914. You've got to be a hyper geek in terms of monetary policy and be willing to spend a couple $100 because it's not an in-print book. But that gives you a range from introduction to the Federal Reserve via The Creature from Jekyll Island, and the author on that is Edward Griffin, to something highly academic and fairly arcane.
Can I just add, Dave, in case the person doesn't want to read, we do have a video called What is Real Money?
And, yes, there you go.
You did that yourself.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. There are people here right now going, no, this ain't going to happen.
Okay, you're right. So yeah. Actually, that's a great point.
Just get on our website.
Is it 30 minutes? Is it 40 minutes? Something like that. A summary of the history of money, its uses, and why gold became the default currency through time. And actually, we do get to borrow some from the ideas of Galrodi, Harold James, and others in terms of the history and the importance of gold in the monetary system from the beginning of recorded history.
Next question. With the gold-silver ratio at 80 to 1 plus, why hold any gold at all? Shouldn't I be in silver all the way and buy back gold later when the ratio drops? Or is it really possible that the ratio can linger for the next 3 to 5 years?
And we had that question last week to some degree. I'd just say that the ratio can go to 100 to 1. I doubt that it will, but it can. And so I guess the question you're asking here as an investor, do you own the metals for asset preservation or do you own them for growth? And to the degree that you're trying to sit the fence between those two, that's how you would end up with diversification between gold and silver. Because asset preservation is the prominent theme, the dominant theme of gold, growth a little bit more of the factor that you get from silver or platinum or palladium. 80 to 1, it certainly argues for a higher ratio there. And, you know, I do not have more than a 50-50 if you're talking about aggregate. I do have specific accounts which are 100% silver, but they're designated for growth. They're designated for the gold-silver ratio. They're designated within tax-deferred structures so that I can aggressively play those ratios. And that would be the only place that I would have 100 to 1. But in aggregate, across a net worth picture and inclusive of an entire precious metals portfolio, I think the only time that that's appropriate is if you, the individual investor, have made the priority growth and have increased your risk profile. You have to acknowledge that and have decreased the importance of asset preservation and protection.
Next question has to do with just taxation in the future of gold. What's the possibility of the government slapping a giant tax on the selling of gold?
Possibility is high. I mean, it can happen. It's not a dumb question.
It's one of the reasons you love IRA gold, too, right? I mean, moving an IRA into gold and silver where you don't have that issue is a great option.
Well, and I mean, I think when you look at land and at gold, gold remains an asset of choice for wealthy families going back hundreds of years across any geography in the world. And as we talked about with the French system in the 1720s, you choose how, you choose where, you choose when to engage with the system, right? And in the case of the Mississippi era, if you got caught holding gold, they would confiscate your entire net worth. They would take everything, right? So the idea that they can slap a giant tax on, yeah, so they do. The question is how you as an individual actor choose to participate in that and how you choose to engage with self-preservation and wealth preservation in the context of those decisions. Only you can make those decisions. There are real ramifications for breaking the law. I'm not advising breaking the law. I just recognize that people throughout time have done what it took to preserve value for themselves and their families and have not played to the interests of the state, even though the state has suggested it, required it, and penalized those who didn't comply with it.
And of course, Dave, anytime we're asked, we always recommend and tell people, pay your taxes. What you're saying, though, is we have no idea what the system looks like at that time. The system itself could be falling apart. We don't even really know what the government entity would be in that case. All right, next question. First off, I just want to thank you guys for the commentary. I've listened to every episode you've produced throughout the last 5 years, and it's been an incredible help to my transition from an average American millennial video gamer to an actual adult with a focus on the future of my family. First, for some background, I originally intended on becoming an engineer, but I switched to social work in the hopes of switching out monetary gain for something intrinsically rewarding. Unfortunately, all I have ended up with is an insane amount of stress and not so much in the way of income. I'm currently 33, and my wife and I together make about $75,000 a year. We are currently purchasing about $150 a month in physical silver, with the occasional purchase of gold if I run into a bonus here and there. We live on a small farm, and we are currently very slowly building our own home without the help of banks. That's awesome. My question is this: what direction would you guys suggest that a person in my financial position should focus? I'm not so much focused on retirement, as I am pretty well convinced that I'm not going to have that option to retire in 30 years into the future, but would instead like to focus on protecting my current meager wealth to pass down as much as possible to my children, currently 2 and 4, when they become adults. Again, thank you guys for all you do. So, Dave, these folks are putting together a house without the banks on $75,000 a year with 2 kids. That's tough. That's admirable.
Yeah, I love this. I would focus on exactly what you're focusing on. Wealth protection, as described, you know, what you're doing with both an acquisition of gold and silver, not getting into a huge amount of debt. I think another goal for you would be creating a duplicative income. You know, right now, the two of you are working and creating $75,000 a year. Is there anything that over time could be, in this case, a third source of income? Hmm. And again, I not shared here the details of living on that farm, but is there something there that could be income generative? And in fact, maybe an entrepreneurial sort of hothouse for your kids, where they're learning to see things from the standpoint of creating value, whether that's selling chickens from the eggs that you have to local stores. I know you wouldn't believe $6-7 a dozen for free range eggs at the farmer's market here in Durango.
Yeah. We pay it at James Ranch.
Right. So there's that in terms of the duplicative income. I would really do that. That is a part of It's a mindset, really. It's a mindset to say, you know, at some point we might need a substitute for one of our incomes, either because of a health issue or because of a personal choice, or the kids are grown and gone, and that duplicative income gives you the flexibility of toning back or dialing back your current workload to something that's less stressful.
I'll tell you what, Dave, the skills that they've gained just living the way they're living means an economic downturn isn't nearly as devastating as it is to actually most of the people listening right now.
Right. So another one, I would be thinking in terms of retirement, but I would not be thinking in terms of your own retirement. I think there's a healthy generational restart here and an opportunity for you. If you're saying, look, there's no point. I'm 33 and there's not going to be anything for me. I'm going to have to work. I'm going to have to provide. Is there something I can do for my kids? I would say yes, wholeheartedly. Absolutely. So look at Roth IRAs for your kids. And you think, well, can I have an IRA for someone who's 2 or 4? Yes, you can start them at any age. They have to have an earned income. But there we go again. If you're creating a duplicative income from something that you're doing on your little ranchette, great. You can assign that income to them. Yes, it means filing. It means they have to have a social security number. It means that they have to file taxes and everything else. But their participation in the family business can be rewarded. And I would use those dollars to fund a Roth IRA for them. Doing so does a couple things for you. By the way, miners are really not allowed to own securities. So you're limited to owning gold and silver in a precious metals IRA. I've done that for our 4 kids. And don't tell them. I haven't told them yet. I'm not planning on telling them until they're in their 20s. nevertheless, I've funded their IRAs for 2, 3, 4 years each. And that's it. But the math works in a fairly compelling manner. If you can set aside a modest amount by the time they're 65, compounding at a very modest rate, you have a very, very healthy number. And it only takes one generation to get this jump started, because what you've done, you've demonstrated to them thinking intergenerationally. You've showed them in real demonstrative terms that money is not just about you, but it's about the other. It's about taking care of other people. It's about taking care of family. And for them to adopt that as a perspective on life and raise their kids in the same way and say, look, my parents say, saved for me and my retirement, I'm saving for your retirement. I'm already taken care of. It's a totally different mindset, and I think it's valuable there.
Well, and I'm just going to add one more thing, because you're probably not going to add it yourself, but read your book on legacy, because these folks sound like they're actually intending on having a legacy for their family.
Well, if you want, feel free to contact me directly, and I'll share the math with you on what doing the gold-silver swaps, the relationship, those ratio trades back and forth inside a tax-deferred vehicle like a Roth, how powerful that is over a 65-year period. If you assume you can go from one position, say silver to gold, and all the way back to silver again, getting to do that about once a decade, start doing the compounding of ounces over 65, 70 years, and it's unreal the number of ounces that end up being there in retirement.
Going to the next question, and Dave, you have no interest in politics. I know that. So if you were in Lawrence Kudlow's job, what policies would you be recommending to the president right now? Can we prevent an economic disaster, or is it inevitable?
this is a question of economic idealism or political pragmatism, because I could give you some ideas that I think would help the economy. The chances of them being implemented are slim to none. The chances of, you know, walking out the door with my job the same day they were recommended are slim to none. And that's the nature of politics. That's one of the reasons why I'm a bit cynical about DC and what happens there, because even if somebody came in with the greatest ideals, you'll be railroaded out once people start weighing the cost of those ideas.
Because it's all about reelection. But Dave, let me ask you, let's pretend like we have a president that doesn't care about being reelected. What would you recommend?
Yeah, I think there are limits to spending, which makes sense. And I think living within our means does make sense. I think the idea of deficit spending is a bad idea. We've adopted it because we can. We can because we have a monetary system that supports it. We can create infinite amounts of credit given the monetary system that we have. I think ultimately that makes for radical boom and bust cycles. On the boom side, everyone loves it. It's on the bust side that it becomes catastrophic. And the reason ultimately why I'm against it philosophically and for sound money is because what happens in the context of a bust cycle is that greater and greater freedoms are taken away from people. And, you know, this was the ratchet effect, which we talked about that in our conversation with Robert Higgs a few years ago, borrowing the ideas from his book Crisis and Leviathan, where, again, every time we go through, again, nobody complains about the boom cycle. Everyone wails. There's great weeping and gnashing of teeth in the bust cycle, which is always bigger when you have a fiat system driving the expansion of credit. And guess what you seed? You seed, that is, transition over a massive amount of individual freedoms to government control. And so that, I think, from a philosophical, political perspective, is why I don't like the radical boom-bust cycle, why I really favor constraints put on government. Who wants constraints on government? Not government. Who wants constraints on credit? Not the banks. So who's the audience for this? The only reasonable way that that would occur is if you had a certain brand of populist president. And that's a populist president probably more in keeping with, say, a Ron Paul. You know, a Ron Paul who is constitutionally oriented to a degree, but is a fairly radical libertarian. Not an anarchist, not an anarcho-capitalist, but somewhere between a constitutionalist and a capitalist. And I think if you could blend the ideals of a constitutionalist and a capitalist, free market capitalist, that is, not crony capitalist, then I think you could start to design some policies which, although not popular, could have a real lasting impact.
Next question from China, but I think it actually applies to us as well, Dave. This is from Chris in Shenzhen, China. Gentlemen, as a non-financial sector professional who has been purchasing precious metals since 2009, how is it that the system has not reset given the following? We've got $20 trillion in debt and $20 trillion unaccounted for Pentagon defense spending. Trillions created for the bailout in 2008, QE, 1, 2, 3, etc. China, Russia, divesting from U.S. treasuries, on and on. Why?
Well, so that's a kind of a U.S.-centric issue, and that's a good question. Why has confidence remained on a broader basis? We've got low estimates, $216 trillion, high estimates, $280 trillion of debt in the global arena, not just the 20 that we have here. So, you know, the issue, Chris, is one thing, confidence. Confidence remains. And just appreciate what confidence means to any market and what it means to social order and what confidence means to the ability to play the games that we have played in the credit markets. Confidence is a very thin thread, and it is the thread that holds the financial universe in its cosmic place today. And that doesn't mean that it holds it there tomorrow. Confidence is a very thin thread. That's the only thing that keeps us in motion.
This next question actually, Dave, deals with our reserve currency status. He says, before I ask, I just want to let you guys know how your show has helped me a lot in understanding the markets, especially on the fundamental side. So thank you for that. Here's my question. By Triffin's dilemma, we cannot have the petrodollar U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency and do that without running a net deficit in trade. If Trump keeps on insisting in reducing the deficit, what is the most likely scenario for the U.S. market? Can we expect rising treasury yields leading to more debt burden on all the sectors of the economy, household, private, government. God bless you guys. And again, thanks for the show.
Yeah. So our deficit is someone else's trade surplus. And so to the degree that we're running deficit, you see surplus dollars, you know, and divided between our trade partners. Those surplus dollars have, through the years, been recycled into U.S. assets. So there is a question about how, and a concern on my part, as to what happens if those surplus dollars are not coming into the United States. Is there an insufficient flow of funds back into the U.S. to support the equities market, to support the debt markets? And I guess what this implies is that in the absence of recycled trade dollars, you would have, at least in the bond market, a rise in interest rates. And certainly the rise in interest rates serves to be a restriction on the financial markets as a whole, with negative implications for the stock market.
You know, sometimes we can be rough on John Maynard Keynes, but in this particular case, he saw this problem right up front. You know, he said, when you have a reserve currency like this, it will lead to trade deficits. In fact, you have to have trade deficits. The problem is there's a fuse, to use your own word, that lights a fuse. There's only so long you can run trade deficits and run that system before it fails.
Now, the interesting thing is that Keynes appreciated something that John Law did not. And the reason Cantillon made his fortune on the Mississippi system was because he understood this bit about having a trade deficit.
Hmm.
And Law did not.
Triffin's dilemma 300 years ago.
It's a very interesting historical, what do you call that, analog. There's one other thing I'd say, and it's you also have the impact on a widening budget deficit. If you're successful in reducing our trade deficit, which is the explicit goal that Trump has stated, what are the implications into our financial markets? Well, you tell me how people start viewing our debt and our dollar with an ever-widening budget deficit. If we don't have money coming in to support the budget deficit, to finance it, those recycled surplus dollars, who's financing it? Who's financing it? We've got debt that is being issued. You have to have a buyer. Who's the buyer? Is this where we move into the next phase of, you know, quantitative easing, or what the central banks have done overseas, what the ECB just ended December of 2018, monetizing debt? Is that what we end up having to do, is monetize debt? Because, you know, you can't have it both. You can't have the world's reserve currency run a trade deficit and not have problems that emerge.
Okay, Vitold wrote this. He says, I have a couple of questions which relate to commodities. I pose these questions within the backdrop of the GSCI, the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, and the S&P 500 ratio, which I believe to be the lowest it's been in 50 years, if not longer. Even though platinum's demand in the industrial processes have dropped off over the past 4 years, the gold to platinum production ratio is about 14 to 1, and production costs for both metals are not dissimilar. The price ratio between the two metals is now 0.685, and I believe that's the lowest it's ever been. My question is, why isn't investment demand more than making up for the industrial demand? Why aren't investors considering platinum as good, if not better, than gold as a store of value? It seems like a no-brainer, he says.
Yeah, well, and I tend to agree. I think on this point that the first GSCI, the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, compared to the S&P 500, if you look at that chart, you have the inflated asset value of the S&P 500, the deflated, these are the numerator denominator, you put those together and you do end up with a radical chart, as cheap as it's been in 50 years. That recognize too that the GSCI is a little bit skewed towards energy. 60 to 70% of the index is energy related, and maybe 10% industrial commodities, 15% ag, 10 to 15%, depending on when it's being constructed, and a very small percentage precious metals. So really energy heavy. Oil is cheap. It's been cheaper, right? But we haven't had these levels of oil and commodities with, at the same time, the S&P 500 being so high. So it is telling you a very interesting story. And if you had to sort of put a caption on it, time to exit financial assets and move to tangibles. That would be the caption.
And I'm thinking that actually ties you right into the second part of his question, because he said, we've been in an everything except commodities bubble since 2012 until today. His question is, what's the probability that we're going to have a major bull market in the 2020s or 2030s in commodities, gold, silver, platinum, what have you.
Right. Well, and I think before we go there on platinum, you know, why isn't industrial demand being overtaken by investment demand? Because people rarely buy bargains.
Right.
People rarely do the right thing at
They'll
the right
buy
time.
At the top.
Bargains. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
No, they buy outperforming assets. They don't buy underperforming assets. And that's why their portfolios generally underperform, because they're not willing to buy value. Yeah, the 2020s, to that last part of the question, I'd say there's a 90% probability that the next major bull market is in that time frame, the 2020s versus the 2030s. And it corresponds with financial assets being at all-time highs. So as you see the mean reversion in financial assets giving up some ground, I think you'll see ground taken back by your tangible commodities. And that's a whole swath of tangible commodities, the most money-like of which would be gold and silver. So, yeah, it has been an everything bubble except commodities. And I think 2018, 2019 looks to be a good transition out of the paper world and into the tangible.
Well, Dave, another fabulous year of questions. And, you know, there were a couple of people who we did not read the question only because we answered it in someone else's. But please, when you have questions for the show, even when we're not doing Q&A programs, feel free to send those in at info@McIlvaney.com, because as we provide guests and bring people in, oftentimes we're trying to listen to what the listeners are saying.
You know, one of the things that I love most each week after we do the commentary and I look back at the week before is seeing the dialogue between the listeners, you know, whether it's on YouTube or in various social media channels where they're talking with each other.
Yeah.
It is an
interesting conversation.
It's a robust conversation.
Yeah.
There's people there who are generous. I'm just amazed. Again, thank you to our listeners for engaging not only in the content of the commentary, but then engaging with each other in a way that is considerate, in a way that is constructive, in a way that is respectful. It speaks to the quality and character of who you are as an individual and your pursuit of truth.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.